foreign entity for that matter. There are no Russian or Chinese influencers or prior government officials of the same caliber as that of Israeli regime. Can you imagine if there were any Senate hearing committees who are currently conducting racist examinations of TikTok by accusing a Singaporean CEO of being a Chinese agent would be gunning X left, right, and center. Musk would be under fire for employing CPC agents or Kremlin assets. However, Israeli intelligence seems to miss that critical bar. Tech giants like X and Meta have always been allowed to operate with near full impunity to sell user data and spy on users themselves at the behest of US agencies like the NSA and FBI. So much so that it is public record that various state agencies are routinely collecting data. It's no surprise that US junior partners, especially ones with unique imperialist interests like Israel, are rarely critically examined when it comes to their own role inside social media giants. However, non-aligned or antagonistic nations that could have the same influence on Twitter find their influencers cracked down on. Musk's reeling in by Netanyahu and the Tel Aviv regime was not X being subverted post October 7th. X, previously known as Twitter, was always subverted in one way or another, not only by agents who swear allegiance to the Israeli occupation, but by the US State Department itself.
Welcome back to Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'll give you my guests in a few minutes, but first a quick look at some of the latest developments. Apartheid Israel steps up attacks on the southern Gaza city of Rafah that shelters 1.4 million Palestinians. Overnight, strikes and raids have killed at least 67 people and injured dozens more, most of them women and children. Hamas has condemned the deadly Israeli attack, saying the offensive is a deepening of genocide against the people of Palestine. Yemen targets an American ship in the Red Sea, reiterating such attacks will persist until Israel halts its genocide in Gaza. The UN, EU, and others warn against Israel's plan for launching a ground invasion of Rafah. A court in the Netherlands orders the Dutch government to stop giving Israel parts for F-35 warplanes, following an appeal by human rights groups. U.S.-Israeli attacks in Gaza have killed more than 28,000 Palestinians and wounded 68,000 others since October last year. Join me on today's edition in the studio, Father Frank Gehly, Anglican priest and pro-Palestinian advocate. And joining us all the way from New York is journalist and author Caleb Maupin. His latest book, Who Are the Houthis and What Are They Fighting For, is now available. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Caleb, we're bracing ourselves for unimaginable devastation as the Israeli onslaught on Rafah gathers pace. Your reflections?
Well, the entire world is horrified by Israeli atrocities, what they are doing. The entire world is demanding a ceasefire. But the only forces that are taking dramatic action to try and make it happen are the Houthis. The Ansar Allah movement and their stopping of ships, this is a picket line. They are saying, do not cross. They are blocking ships in the Red Sea and saying they want the killing of the Palestinians to end. And the fact that this is condemned by certain forces internationally, including my own government here in the United States, is absolutely outrageous, because at this point, everything needs to be done to save Palestinian lives. We have every international body looking into these details and saying what's going on is unacceptable. the Houthis are taking action, and they are the conscience of all of us.
And Kayla, what kind of impact are Ansarullah having? They have been doing this for a couple of months now. The aim, as you say, is to put an end to force Israel's hand and to get its allies to get Israel to stop the ongoing genocide. What kind of impact have Ansarullah had so far?
Well, there has been a rise in prices internationally because of the stopping of ships. And then we've also seen this onslaught of bombing carried out by the United States, to try and, stop them from taking this action. But that has not deterred them. And as I talk about, in my recently published book, Who Are the Houthis and What Are They Fighting For? The founder of the movement of Ansarullah, Hussein al-Houthi, before his martyrdom, he told his followers that there would come a time when they would have to stand with Palestine when no one else in the world would. So for the people in Yemen who have built this movement, they see this as the fulfillment almost of prophecy, that they expected a day like this would come. They are willing to give their lives and sacrifice in order to stand with Palestine. They see this as a test of their faith, a test of their commitment to justice, and so they have no intention of stopping their operations in the Red Sea.
And they have made that amply clear. Father Gelly, what do you think Tel Aviv, the Netanyahu gang, are hoping to achieve in Gaza beyond an escalation of the genocide and, of course, the complete displacement of Palestinians?
Certainly a motive of the Israeli ferocious campaign is revenge. The revenge is a very primitive motive. It has nothing to do with justice, but it is deeply ingrained in the mentality of Zionism and Israelis. So there is that sort of primitive element which is there. But another aspect is Netanyahu says he wants to annihilate Hamas. Now, that really, if you unpack that, is annihilate the Palestinian resistance. Because Hamas was, perhaps still is, to some extent, a resistance movement which has inflicted some damage on the Zionist occupation. It has given a bloody nose to the Israeli state, the occupation regime. So in that sense, the annihilation of Hamas, the complete destruction of Hamas, including, of course, the killing of thousands and thousands of innocent Palestinians already take place, women, children, the elderly, all, would be part of the, symbolize the destruction of any conceivable opposition. It's not very brutal, very brutish, very sort of uncivilized, I would say. But also there is also the aspect, of course, that Netanyahu knows very well that when he steps down, he may well end up in prison because he was under investigation for various corruption offenses and the like. So he's trying to present himself as a big chief to his own population, so that they may actually confirm him in power, perhaps prevent him from going to jail where he belongs. I personally think Netanyahu, given his crime, belongs more than to jail. It belongs to something, a punishment a bit more radical, but I think I'll leave it at that.
Let me get Caleb's thoughts on this, too. What do you think Tel Aviv is hoping to achieve here? Because definitely what we're going to see is an escalation of the genocide and, of course, millions of Palestinians being displaced yet again. Caleb, we can hear you. My colleagues, of course, will be fixing that.
It seems that one of the clear goals administration is to escalate into a full-on conflict with the Islamic Republic of Iran. They think that is the only way that they can come out of this successful. The fact that they have murdered the Iranian generals in Syria, the fact that they are threatening to possibly invade Lebanon and have piled up on the Lebanese border, the fact that the Biden administration has been kind of forced into a situation where they're now, attacking the resistance forces in both Syria and in Iraq, it seems like provoking a regional conflict between the United States and Israel on one side and Iran and its allies on another is the end game that Netanyahu is going for. However, this would not be strategic or beneficial, because at this point, the entire region is lined up against Israel and sees allies of Iran, like the Houthis, like Hezbollah, as heroes for what they're doing to stand with the Palestinians. So the entire region would stand at this point with Iranian forces that are opposing Israel. So this is a kind of almost suicidal on Israel's part, but it seems to be what the Netanyahu administration thinks it can do in order to save its position.
And a lot of warnings, of course, coming in against that planned operation that the Israelis have in mind. One such warning against the incursion into Rafah has come from the EU foreign policy, Josep Borrell, saying that an Israeli offensive on Rafah would lead to an unspeakable humanitarian catastrophe and grave tensions with Egypt. EU development ministers are in meeting in Brussels, and will also be discussing the future of UNRWA funding with the agency's commissioner general. Have a listen, and we'll be right back.
Well, many people say that even the president of the U.S. said yesterday that the operations are no longer proportional, that they are excessive, that the toll of people being killed is unbearable. I think it is a sentence that more and more comes from many people around the world. Even the U.S., who is the strongest supporter of Israel, considered it by the President Biden himself that this action is disproportionated, that the toll of people being killed, civilians being killed, is unbearable, and warning Israel not to continue this way. But my question is, apart from words, what else do you think it has to be done? If you believe that the toll of death is too high, do you have any possibility to make it lower? We have to continue putting pressure on Israel, to have to continue to support the humanitarian crisis. But if they launch an offensive against a highly populated area with more than 1.7 million people crash against a wall, they cannot escape. You know, when there is a war, people escape. But people in Gaza cannot escape. They are in closed door. They are being bombed without being able to escape. So this is the situation. So I hope that the whole world will take stock of it.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell there. Father Gelly, will some observers, such as yourself, not point out that Josep Borrell there and the EU actually helped the genocide get thus far?
Yes, I mean, could there be anything more ludicrous that after the Hague Tribunal warned about the impending genocide in Gaza, the EU, many of the EU countries, decided to stop funding UNRWA, which is the only body which is helping, in practical terms, the suffering Palestinians. So in a way, that sort of stresses the problem. The EU maybe means well, but in reality, there is no action. There is no practical steps are being taken. And maybe they're terrified of this charge of being anti-Semitic, this great bugbear. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ai Weiwei, the great Chinese artist who is left China because he's opposed to the regime.
In the States.
He had an exhibition coming up in Kensington Gardens. It was actually shut down because he sent a couple of tweets concerning what is happening in Palestine. Oh. And he was immediately, and he has spoken, saying the censorship in the West is getting as bad as China. So maybe the EU pusillanimous cowardly EU leaders are afraid of being indicted anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. But that, in a way, is a triumph for absurdity. The Semites who are now being exterminated are the Arabs, are Palestinians, they're Semites too.
Mm. And Caleb, a lot of people are saying that the plan to strike Rafah has drawn these significant reactions from the U.S., the U.K., and the rest, other Israeli allies, as well as aid agencies. Is that an indication, in your opinion, that there is, we've arrived at a point now that there is some kind of a fracture in terms of the support that these allies have given Israel for so many months?
Well, when you have leading Israeli officials and spokespeople going as far as trying to claim that the United Nations Relief Works Agency is a front for Hamas and making outrageous conspiracy theories like that in order to justify these actions against a well-respected international body that basically just trying to prevent any food from being delivered, just trying to prevent any relief being provided to the Palestinians, just so they can just carry out these genocidal operations. At some point, international voices have to look on and say, okay, this is insanity. We have seen very embarrassing behavior from the United States, particularly the United Nations, just doing everything they can to protect Israel from any criticism before the UN Security Council. You know, just any resolution that might in any way restrict Israel's activities has been vetoed. But that's not enough. It is never enough, it seems, for the pro-Israeli lobby in the United States. You know, in the United States, we have laws in a number of states that you have to pledge that you will not boycott Israel in order to be employed by the U.S. state. And that's completely unconstitutional, and it's completely absurd. I mean, can you imagine to work for a government institution in the United States? You must pledge loyalty and promise to never boycott a foreign government. This is outrageous, but it's still not enough, right? And if you listen to the Zionists, they are the most oppressed people in the world. They are the ultimate victims, and that then gives them license to kill the Palestinians at the massive rate that they are killing them. So there is a section of the population in the United States that is, you know, under the spell of the Israeli lobby that is just out of touch with reality. And I think that explains the recent attacks on the United Nations Relief Works Agency and calls to cut off its funding.
And I mean, on the one hand, as you say, the U.S. administration, regardless of who is in power, does whatever they can to make sure Israel has whatever it needs, to borrow a word or two from President Biden. But then my question, I guess, is that what does that say about the American leverage over Israel? I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are saying all it takes is for the American president or someone in the U.S. administration to pick up that phone and call Netanyahu and say, look, we have run out of runway. You have to stop it now.
Well, that would be great if it were to happen, but I'm not confident that it will. We did see beneath the surface, you know, some criticism of Israel. You know, just as Obama was leading office, the United States made a very big point of displaying opposition to Israel at the United Nations Security Council. But it was symbolic. We'll remember that right before Trump took office. And even though Donald Trump, you know, made a big point of saying how pro-Israel he was, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, et cetera, we did see every so often there would be little hints from the Trump administration that indicated there was some, you know, tension beneath the surface. But at the end of the day, it seems like Israel does have its grip over American politics. It's well cemented into the American foreign policy establishment. I find it very unlikely that we will see forces step up and just straight up denounce Israel or cut off funding or anything like that.
Mm. And no such denunciation coming from Europe either, Father Galley. We heard, of course, from the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, saying that, you know, this is not right. Israel has to pause and think before it proceeds with this massive incursion of Rafah. And that there has to be a pause, and that might lead to what the British government would like to call a sustainable ceasefire. At the same time, as I mentioned at the top of the program, we heard the Dutch court calling on the government to cancel the sales of parts to be used in F-35 warplanes that are being used to bomb the Palestinians in Gaza. The court has and noted a clear risk that the parts are being used in serious violations of international humanitarian law. Yet we haven't seen a move like that here in the UK that continues to sell parts and weaponry to the Israelis.
Interesting what you said about Cameron, who has made a few very timid statements about the wrongness of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. I wonder if there is some sort of Freudian thing there, because after all, it is Britain, which in 1916, during the middle of the First World War, issued a famous Balfour Declaration. Balfour was a foreign secretary at the time, establishing a national home, they called it, for the Jewish people in Palestine, which was still under Ottoman rule at the time. In reality, of course, what that led was a massive influx immigration of Jews into Palestine and eventually to the establishment of the State of Israel at the end of the Second World War. So maybe the British, maybe Cameron, as an old Etonian and an educated Brit, has some lingering sort of guilt feeling about that. In reality, of course, nothing will happen. Mm. Nothing will happen because the overwhelming influence of a Zionist lobby, of Zionist networks. You mentioned the case of Holland. Yeah, Holland's a small state, a tiny state. She doesn't, you know, no offense to Dutch people, it doesn't mean very much on the overall scheme. It is taken, yeah, the Hague Tribunal, the recent developments that you cited, but it's not really amounted to much. In the case of Britain, actually, someone, a friend of mine, criticised me because I said online that Britain is just America's lapdog. Say, no, Britain is a bit more than that. It's not just
that. They called Tony Blair George Bush's poodle, didn't they, at the time of the U.S. letting
Yes, yes. And, of course, Bush had offered him to keep out, yeah, not to send troops, but Tony Blair wanted to be alongside the Americans.
I'd like to talk about
that.
Blair and Bush a little later. While we're in Britain, a majority of the U.K.'s population support a ceasefire in Gaza, but the government continues to supply arms to the Zionist Israel and enable them to continue their genocidal war on the Palestinians. This according to Palestinian activist Mark Sudan, who says he will punish the UK main opposition Labour Party, too, for being complicit come this election.
I think the government is too intimidated by the Zionist lobby in this country and by Israel. What they seem to ignore is that there are many Jewish people, decent, honourable Jewish people, who are standing in solidarity with the people of Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza and on the West Bank. I applaud them for their heroism because they are making it clear that what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank is not in their name, and they are speaking out consistently and emphatically against what the Israeli government are doing. And these are Jewish people, and it's not just a handful of Jewish people, they are in their thousands across the globe. So I salute them and I stand in solidarity with them, but for whatever reason, governments in the West, and the UK government in particular, is ignoring them, but they can't ignore the voice of the people forever. I was a member of the Labour Party up until the end of 2020. I resigned for a whole range of reasons to do with the suppression of free speech, the hounding and the maligning of decent members of the Labour Party on the spurious grounds of anti-Semitism. But apart from that, I think the Labour Party, which I'd been a member of for 40 years before I resigned, has become a corrupt and morally degenerate organisation. So I will be doing absolutely nothing that to help elect a Labour government led by Keir Starmer. I'm not sure yet how I will be voting, but I definitely know how I will not be voting.
The U.S.-Israeli genocide of Gazans has spilled out into a regional issue. Over the weekend, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian was in Lebanon and warned Benjamin Netanyahu of any extensive attack against Lebanon.
Any move by the Zionist regime to launch an extensive attack against Lebanon will determine the day for an end to the Netanyahu and an end to the current situation in the region. The key to the security of shipping in the Red Sea is a halt to the crisis, war and genocide in Gaza. Naturally, the Islamic Republic of Iran will strongly support any initiative about Gaza and the West Bank, which centers around the Palestinian people and leaders.
Let's continue the conversation with my guests, Father Frank Gehly and Caleb Maupin, as we enter the final minutes of this broadcast. Final question to you, Caleb. George Bush, the former American president, and Tony Blair, the former PM here, committed their career-defining error of invading Iraq, if you recall, of course, and haven't been able to walk away from it. How will history judge those political leaders who justified and tolerated the Israeli regime's ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza, do you think?
I think it's very clear if you look at the world today, there are two economies now. You have the decaying Atlanticist international system, Western capitalism, imperialism, capitalism in its monopoly stage, centered around the city of London, centered around the Wall Street Stock Exchange. And then in addition to that, you have the rising alternative, the BRICS countries that are building. You have the Bolivarian alternative for Latin America. You have the Belt and Road Initiative of China, the Eurasian Economic Union, and you have the Axis of Resistance in the Middle East. And that is the new economy. And I think historians will look at this period and what Israel is doing. They will see this as the desperate viciousness of a dying old order. Israel was created as an outpost of the Atlanticist international system. It was set up to be an outpost of the British Empire, a settler state. Winston Churchill talked about how he could use the Jews as settlers in the Middle East, and he saw Zionism as an alternative to Marxism, and that is how it's going to be remembered. This is the desperate viciousness of the dying Atlanticist international system as the people of the world resist, and an alternative economy centered around growth and economic development, people-centered development is emerging.
Correct. Gentlemen, fascinating. I'd like to continue, but I'm told we're fresh out of time. Frank Gehly, Father Frank Gehly, and Caleb Maupin, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for spending time with us. Gaza Under Attack will be back. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Germany's industrial output extended its slump to a seventh month in December, underlining the struggles gripping Europe's largest economy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg Television has covered this story and tells us more. Germany's economic woes keep mounting as early surveys show gloom for 2024 and a bumpy road ahead. According to the American-based news network, investors lending money to German companies are now demanding higher interest rates than companies in the rest of the Eurozone. This is due to several factors, including the struggling German economy, real estate troubles, and Germany's reputation for having the highest corporate distress ranking in Europe. This predicament came about due to surging energy prices, which began after Germany joined the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Consequently, the country had to cut off its supply of cheap Russian gas to its energy-dependent manufacturing sector. Brian Mangwiro, a fund manager at Barings, told Bloomberg Television, "Germany is really in trouble. All the big manufacturing economies are slowing down, but in Germany, this is compounded by higher energy costs. There are also challenges in the auto sector, with competition coming from China. There has been a marked decline in borrowing by businesses to invest in factories, machinery, and technology. This shows that Germany's economic growth is impeded in the long term, while companies are currently more focused on tackling their problems. The bigwigs at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland last January were feeling quite despondent. It was evident that Europe's largest economy was experiencing instability and grappling with fierce competition from other market players in the fields of machinery and car production, particularly in the domain of electric vehicles. The problem is further compounded by interest rate hikes over the last 2 years, revealing setbacks in the German property market. According to data gathered by Bloomberg Television, in January, more than $13.6 billion in loans and bonds doled out by companies in the country were distressed, which is 13 times Italy's level. A report by Alvarez and Marsal, a consulting company, says that roughly 15% of firms in the recession-hit Germany are in trouble. Additionally, Germany is facing a budget crisis. Sources familiar with the budget calculations disclosed, despite Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition government managing to overcome the difficult challenge of passing this year's budget, there's still a 20 billion euro gaping hole in the budget expected in 2025. Germany's budget problems have caused a decline in approval ratings for Olaf Scholz's SPD, Habeck's Greens, and Lindner's FDP. The AfD now polls at 19% and shows no signs of losing ground, just trailing behind the Christian Democrats, the CDU, with 32%. The website of Euronews has also covered the same story. German industrial output extended its slump to a seventh month in December, underlining the struggles gripping Europe's largest economy. The Statistics Office said on Wednesday, 7th of February, production fell 1.6% from November, led by chemicals and construction sector. The drop was far worse than the 0.5% decline predicted by analysts in a Euronews survey. The overall level of production is now at its lowest level since June of 2020, and stripping out the shock of the pandemic, the last time it was so weak was way back in 2010. Germany is facing a potential recession after output shrank by 0.3% in the fourth quarter of 2023. And this year began on a shaky footing. The data underscore the difficulty in reviving the economy amid weak global demand, high interest rates, and the enduring consequences of the energy crisis. There was mixed news in recent days when figures showed an unexpected jump in December factory orders, albeit only thanks to major orders, alongside a continued slide in exports. The inflation and employment backdrop remains more positive. Consumer price growth slowed more than the expected in January to 3.1%, and a drop in joblessness underscored the labour market's surprising resilience. But the German Finance Minister Christian Lindner warned that Germany is suffering because of its failure to boost output. He told a Euronews event on Monday, 5th of February, in Frankfurt, Germany, he said, "We're no longer competitive. We are getting poorer because we have no growth. We're falling behind." China's Xinhua News Agency has also covered the same story. According to provisional figures published by the Federal Statistics Office, the Statis, recently German companies started 12.3% more insolvency procedures in December of 2023 compared to the same period in 2022. It was the seventh month in a row with double-digit year-on-year growth in the number of new insolvency procedures in Germany. According to DStatis, from January to October of 2023, corporate insolvencies were up 24.1% year-on-year. The German Hospital Federation warned at the end of last year the situation in hospitals is worse than ever before, expecting insolvencies to reach record levels in 2024. According to a survey by the German Hospital Institute, around 70% of the country's hospital operators fear that the economic situation in the country will deteriorate further this year. The retail sector has also been affected. Recently, Germany's largest department store chain, Galeria Karstadt Kaufhof, had to file for insolvency due to the collapse of its holding company, Signa Group. It was the third insolvency filing for the troubled store chain in less than 4 years. The catering industry in Germany is also anticipating a growth in insolvency proceedings. Since the beginning of 2024, the earlier value-added tax rate of 19% on restaurant meals has been reinstated after the government had reduced it to 7% during the COVID-19 pandemic. The German Hotel and Restaurant Association said at the end of last year, as a result, business closures and insolvencies will be inevitable from March of 2024. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to preliminary figures published by the Federal Statistics Office, DStatis, on Monday, 5th of February, Germany's imports and exports both declined in 2023 amid recession. According to the figures, exports of Europe's largest economy were down 1.4% from 2022 to 1.56 trillion euros, while imports slumped 9.7% to 1.35 trillion euros. Caroline Herweg, an expert at the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, said 2023 was a lost year for Germany's export industry. She said high inflation and high interest rates, as well as geopolitical risks, had reduced demand, which caused the drop in exports of goods. Dirk Yandura, president of the country's Wholesale Foreign Trade and Services Association, said, with exports to key markets stagnating or declining, last year's figures reflect the continued weakness of German foreign trade. The German Economic Institute assumes that the country's export model will remain in crisis this year as the geopolitical situation continues to be uncertain. The German Economic Institute said at the end of last year that after registering fewer foreign orders for 2 years, many German industrial companies were holding back on investments.
Bazaar.
The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. Hello everyone, Ali Reza here, welcoming you to a brand new edition of Bazaar. This week, we are taking you on a journey through Iran's mammoth building construction industry while highlighting some of the country's recent developments in this sector. Plus, we will check out its market as a whole and the construction industry's contributions to the national economy. So, let's get started. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years. Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the events. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services. This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations. All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into 2 main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region. This sector suffered a lot after the US withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials imports. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits. Alright, now it's time to check out this week's special feature of Bazaar. So let's see where Sarah has been this past week.
In an ever-increasing technology-driven world, city streets are becoming more and more congested than ever before, while connected and autonomous technologies in vehicles are also on the rise. Such safety concerns pose a significant challenge for city planners and traffic engineers to improve mobility, safety, and efficient use of roadways now and in the future. When you are driving to work, or especially going on a road trip, you need to be fully alert to avoid the hidden cameras all across the road from catching you or costing you a damage. Well, sometimes this can be really irritating, but have you ever thought of the significant impacts they have in the most challenging situations? Today, we decided to take you to a company active in the field of intelligent transportation system in Sharif University of Technology. Let's go check it out. With creating intelligent transportation systems, the research and development team of the students in Sharif University of Technology has created a smart traffic software for processing related information. These smart systems are mounted beside or over the roads to detect motoring offenses, including speeding, vehicles going through a red traffic light, vehicles going through a toll booth without paying, or for recording vehicles inside a congestion charge area. All these violations are detected 24/7 using traffic data analysis system.
We as Connect Group started to work around 10 years ago here in Electronic Research Institute in Sharif University of Technology. Back then, our main expertise was focused on image processing and embedded systems and also IoT devices for smart cities and buildings. Our products are all knowledge-based and divide into three main categories. The first one is machine vision and embedded systems. The other part of the products are based on IoT or Internet of Things products. And the third one is the big data analysis and data mining. These products are all implemented on a secure and highly customized Linux operating system. Another line of our products are based on IoT devices, such as the smart gateways and actuators. We have exported these products to two foreign countries, and also the third line of our products are based on data mining and big data analysis. These softwares and products are mainly used in road maintenance and transportation organization and also some major municipality offices. These softwares helps a lot in extracting useful patterns out of millions and billions data in traffic control centers and help managers and also managers and experts in traffic control sensors to extract practical and beneficial data from these smart cameras or sensors throughout the city.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this intelligent software was created for the smart camera system. When it comes to cameras, we have various kinds of traffic enforcement cameras, such as speed violation detection camera, red light camera, road safety camera, and so many more for plate detection. But that's not all. This company also creates IoT devices or Internet of Things. These are intelligent gateway camera systems for buildings and image processing with the aim of providing a better living environment for people and reducing energy consumption. All right, now it's time to take a closer look at the smart camera system and see how it works. There are thousands of smart camera systems all across the country that actually function with the software created in this company. Now, let's take a look at one of the smart camera systems created in this company. Well, just like human, this smart system is created and is made of eyes, and if we delve inside, it's also made of a powerful brain. Well, the eye of this system is the industrial camera, which is created in different versions depending on the geographic location of the camera. For example, the one we have here has been created with a hardware design that protects against a heat wave. Anyway, this camera captures the images from the front side of this smart system and sends these images to the processing board, which functions as the brain part of this smart system. And finally, the data is transmitted from the intelligent software of the smart system to the traffic control centers all across the city.
The Connect Group was founded in some 8 years ago, I think. And the main focus of the group was on cutting-edge smart technologies, for example, in machine vision, machine learning, artificial intelligence, data analytics, Internet of Things, and stuff like that. Later on, we use these technologies in more specific areas, for example, in intelligent transportation systems and various aspects of smart cities, like smart buildings, smart automation. And we have other countries around us that they are interested in some of our products. Our main goal for the future is to actually connect all the intelligent aspects of the city together. For example, if you have something smart in a villa or in an apartment, we connect it to the road, we connect it to the work office, and all these things all together to for one brain actually to decide for the optimization and improvement of several aspects of the these systems.
Employing the latest smart technologies as well as artificial intelligence, this company focuses on smart city and smart buildings, and ultimately, it aims at city management without human involvement. Presently, their products are available in almost 17 provinces in Iran. Traffic technologies continue to evolve and scale into solutions in mega cities. Finally, this paves the way to optimizing traffic flow and improving efficiency and safety on the roads. Well, there is no way to violate the traffic rules. The latest technologies in the modern world today, including the smart camera system, can detect and improve the wrong behaviors of drivers in the society. And by the end of the day, they can create a smarter, safer, and more sustainable transportation ecosystem. I've been Sarah Dema, and I'll see you next time.
We are getting close to the end of the program, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the construction industry and beyond. Iran is known for its creative experts in the field of engineering, so it is no surprise that last year the country exported technical and engineering services valued at nearly $2 billion.
That's based on Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. These services were sent to countries in Southeast Asia, North Africa, and neighboring regions. For example, 57 major infrastructural projects were carried out by dozens of Iranian companies in Iraq alone. Furthermore, the organization says with more planning and resources, the country can quickly increase exports of technical and engineering services to $20 million annually. In the last 15 years, Iran has taken on some 900 construction projects in 21 countries worth $32 billion.
Unconventional use of construction material. An Iranian architect has transformed a widely used construction material into a unique form of window. It is a type of spectacled brick that is a solid block with a circular aperture at its core which filters in the light.
The architect says the high density of buildings and city regulations in Tehran has limited sunlight exposure in office and commercial buildings. The developer explains the special brick in this project allows sunlight penetration even in parts of the building where windows are not permitted by city codes. Additionally, these unique windows can be adjusted to closed or open positions to optimize daylight exposure. The advantage of this brick is that it can absorb less air pollution and help filter out the noise from the motorways.
Increasing market reach. And let's conclude with Iran's efforts to expand its market reach and trade of goods with its neighbors. The country is organizing 6 exhibitions in the Qatari capital, Doha, that will be held during this year's FIFA World Cup event.
5 exhibitions will introduce Iranian handcrafts, such as hand-woven carpets, home decorations, and much more. Additionally, 1 will be held for construction materials and technical engineering services. This is significant for increasing bilateral relations and trade between the 2 nations. Government officials also say a direct shipping line has been launched between Iran and Qatar to help with the transportation and distribution of goods.
That wraps up our program for today. Also, if you have a topic that you're interested in, you can send us your thoughts and suggestions via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in and take care. And bye-bye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 53rd letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha.